So I thought to begin with, I'd redeem a promise about radishes. You may remember that came up in the first talk, you may not. There was a joke about turnips and radishes, wasn't there? So, radishes. So Saraha, who is one of the great Mahasiddhas, one of whose disciples was Maitripa, and he was a teacher of Mapa, so he's important. He wanted some radishes to eat, and he asked his companion, wife, whoever she was, to find and cook some for him, which she does very kindly. And meanwhile, he goes into samadhi for 12 years, and so he comes out of samadhi. 12 years is always 12 years, as we know that now. He comes out of samadhi and he says, "Where's my radishes?" And she says, "Well, you know, they've spoiled and now they're out of season. You were meditating for so long, you know." And he says, "Oh, well, I'll go off and meditate in the mountains." And she says, "Well, the best solitude is that of the mind, free from names and conceptions. You were meditating for 12 years, but you were still thinking about radishes. What good will it do you to go to the mountains?" So I think she is a wisdom darkini. And he says, you know, he says it's a fair cop, and resolves to realise the essence of mind. Nice story. So I don't think we've finished in our study probably the grey rock badger enclosure. I know we haven't in our group, but we're going to move on in the talk at least to introducing the next chapter, which is called Milarepa's First Meeting with Rucchungpa. But I'd like to just recap on the grey rock badger enclosure a little bit, partly because I didn't really have much time at the end of the introduction to say much about it that was well thought out. And also I think the two stories go together, and what's interesting about them taken together is that Milarepa has three meetings. So he meets with the yogi, three different kinds of meetings with three different kinds of people who, you know, have three different kinds of relationships with Milarepa. So he meets with the yogi who's already practicing and has faith in Milarepa. And then on the way to meet Rucchungpa, which is prophesied, isn't it? He meets the builders who don't seem to know who he is and don't have faith in him, at least initially. And then, you know, Rucchungpa does find Milarepa in the cave, and Rucchungpa's response to Milarepa is very, very strong in terms of faith. So you have, you know, different kinds of meetings. So it's worth sort of maybe seeing the whole two chapters together and then seeing what Milarepa does with those different kinds of meetings, how he responds, what he teaches. So, yes, the yogi in the grey rock badger enclosure, he's a tantric yogi, so he's practicing some kind of tantric Mahamudra path. We don't know what he's practicing, and he's not getting the results that he's expected. So Milarepa, he asks, doesn't he? He has faith, and Milarepa is in a state of inspiration. So you have a meeting of faith and inspiration, as it were. He asks for an appropriate teaching. And Milarepa gives him the Song of the Six Essentials, which is quite a profound view of the Mahamudra view of mind, which, you know, I won't recap because we've probably looked at that. And the yogi listens to that. Maybe Milarepa's trying to give him a broader perspective, give him a glimpse of the nature of mind. And his response, the yogi's response, is to ask about sudden and gradual realization. So he's obviously on some kind of gradual path, and this is a bit of a sort of, this is it sort of thing. And it doesn't seem as though he's obviously inspired, but perhaps he hasn't had in that interaction a glimpse. And Milarepa says, well, if, you know, a well-destined disciple, how he puts it, it's okay with the sudden path, but if you're kind of inferior or middle, as it were, you need a gradual path, the path of means. So that's quite interesting, I think, in terms of the three meetings, because in a way you've got those three things, I think, in those three meetings. The yogi is on a gradual path, and he's open. The builders, They're not on the path as yet. And Rechungpa is just very open, isn't he, to meeting Mirepa, kind of with great faith and samadhi, and he has realizations very quickly. So that's kind of borne out in the stories. And that this kind of idea of three capacities is very much something I think a teacher introduced as a way of kind of working with it. There are different paths, and in the teacher's rendition of it, you would be sort of inferior, as it were. You probably wouldn't use these words. If you wanted a good rebirth, you would be middling if you wanted to escape from samsara, and you would have great capacity if you wanted to practice for the benefit of all sentient beings. So there's a kind of that already kind of exists in the Dharma. With Minarepa, it's more perhaps Sutra and Tantra Mahamudra are more sort of for the middling, and Essence Mahamudra for those of great capacity. So he then unfolds to the yogi the four yogas, which are a sort of progressive practice and realization of Mahamudra, which we explored. One pointedness, simplicity, one taste, and non-meditation. And he gives both a true realization of that, doesn't he, and a sort of false realization of that. So perhaps he's giving the yogi something to kind of measure himself by, and the false realization of those yogas, the four yogas, is that you talk about it, but you haven't realized it. So you're kind of still very much caught up in concepts, you know, you think because you understand something intellectually, you've got it, which I think is one of the difficulties we have in the West. We're so sophisticated with our concepts, it's quite easy for us to think we've got it. We also have another side which think we haven't got it and we can't have it and we can't do it, but we seem to go between the two of us. So yes, he unfolds the four yogas of Mahamudra. And the yogi is inspired, but what he does is interesting. He asks for a teaching on the six perfections. So it's a bit like he's kind of had a greater vision of mind unfolded to him, but he kind of knows what he needs. So it's as though Minarepa's taught the view in the song of the six essentials. He's taught practice in the song of the four yogas. And I'm indebted to Darshavani for pointing this out, that perhaps in the song of the six perfections, he's being taught conduct. So, you know, that triad of view, practice, conduct. Because the paramitas are something you practice in life. And it's quite a pithy exposition, isn't it, of the six paramitas. Minarepa's teaching from his, he hasn't got notes or anything, he's just teaching from his immediate, spontaneous, whatever. And so that's what he gives the yogi. It's quite pithy, so presumably the yogi can remember it and go away and practice it. And it does have a Mahamudra tinge, doesn't it? Because the last one about wisdom is to look within your own mind for the truth or for Buddha. So he goes off, comes back with other patrons, and they then ask him, they've heard his life before, and they then ask him to tell them about his probationship with Marpa, his ascetic practice, and how he realized enlightenment. And he sings them the song of the six resolutions, which we may not have got onto in our study. We haven't in our group anyway as yet. And so what he sings them this song, which the first part of which is the six resolutions, and that's a teaching on renunciation. And the second part, beginning with the space-like Dharmakaya, which we had read in the puja last night also, is a teaching on the nature of mind. And that is a way in which Minarepa teaches. It's, I think it comes up again in the next chapter when he's teaching a path. So he starts with renunciation, and then he teaches the nature of mind. Later in Buddhism, particularly with Tsongkhapa, has a three principles of the path, which is renunciation, Bodhi mind, and wisdom. So, you know, the Bodhisattva idea is the central kind of plank of that path. And I suppose with Minarepa, perhaps that's implicit, as it were. I mean, he is the Bodhisattva, he's there and he's the Bodhisattva. So perhaps that's expressed as in his being. So he seems to teach this first of all, you must renounce, and then this is the nature of mind. And it's a radical path of renunciation, isn't it, which he says. He says, give up the world. Perhaps he means give up samsara rather than the world, because the world is kind of everything in the world. It's not necessary to give all that up. The samsaric world. Give up home ties. Give up your native land. Give up family ties, because they lead to anger and also they lead to passion. Be content with little. Give up the eight worldly winds, or let go of them, and give up pride and go and live in the mountains. So he is a radical renunciate. That's his path. And as I said earlier, I think he sets the bar of renunciation very high. And, you know, that's not always easy for us to relate to. And we have sort of all kinds of responses and even reactions to that. So if I say to you, renunciation, you know, just how does that feel? Where does that land, and how does that feel? Just notice that. I'm not going to ask you, but just notice that. And I think for many people it doesn't sit necessarily very easily. And particularly his kind of radical renunciation. We had quite a discussion about this in the group about Minarepa. And it's not our path, is it? It's not our path to renounce all ties with kith and kin. Maybe we don't live in our native village or our native land, and maybe we have sort of left home in that sense. But yes, we're practicing in a different kind of way. We're neither lay nor monastic, and although we have teachings about going forth, you know, we're trying to see through the nature of samsara. We're trying to see impermanence, insubstantiality, and dukkha. In our lives, we're trying to loosen up, you know, our fixations, our delusions. We're certainly trying to do that. Maybe we think more in terms of going forth is to do with going forth from mental states, and not so radically going forth. And that is our path. And Bhagishri and I both remembered when we'd read this and we talked about it in the group, a talk Bhante gave, which must have been in 1987 or 1988, because it was called 20 Years in the Middle Way. So I can't remember if it was 20 years in the FWBO or the WBO, but it was in York Hall. And had an effect, quite a strong effect on both of us, and if you were there, maybe on you also, where one of the things he was talking about in terms of the middle way was the middle way in relationship to our parents. So he was saying, well, we do need to be individual in relationship to our parents. We do need to feel free to live our own lives in the way that we want them to, creatively, and not feel, as we, you know, can and often do feel, guilty in relationship to our parents, or, you know, we're not doing what they would like us to do, and you know, we compromise, and yeah, we feel under sort of obligation in a kind of less creative sense. So he was saying we do need to go forth and be individual. That's one sort of side, but also, if we do that, then we'll be able to relate more creatively to our parents with metta and with compassion, and take them into account and be positive in relationship to them. So that's more where it's our ground of practice, isn't it, in relationship to family and kith and kin. And you know what we know from our life in the order, and as we're much older now than we were then, those of us who were there, that we do and have, you know, taken care of our parents and are taking care of our parents. And, you know, we grow and develop from that, as well as, you know, we help our parents who looked after us when we needed looking after. So we need to take all that into account. And also, well, Minarepa, he just exemplifies this path of radical renunciation, which can be an inspiration, even though that's not going to necessarily be the way we practice, although we may choose to practice more in that way at some points in our life. You know, we may go off on a long solitary and you know, not have communication and go off on a long retreat. So it's not as though we don't practice in that way to some extent. So it can be an inspiration for us. I think the other thing that Bhante said in this study with him and in other seminars on Minarepa, that, well, Minarepa's own family background was not a happy one. You know, he needed to, but he just done some such dreadful things, and you know, on the urging of his mother, he needed to, in order to work out his karma, he just had to have that kind of path. It's not the only reason for having that kind of path. So that's one point. Another point is that I suppose the tradition, the society, the culture in which he lived would have been one, although there was nomadic ways of life in Tibet, probably it was a culture with a large extended family. You know, you lived in one place for hundreds of years, you lived with your extended family, that was it. And although that could be positive, that could also be quite claustrophobic. And that's not our experience of life in the modern West. And Banti makes this point quite strongly that we tend to, rather than free wandering, we tend to sort of rootlessness and, you know, alienation and lack of connection and cynicism and all that. So, you know, we're in a different context. And he says, well, we need, in a way, to feel rooted and to feel connected. And we could take this as a kind of carte blanche to just carry on being unconnected, disconnected and alienated. So we, you know, we just need to look at all this in terms of our own experience. And I'm sure we'll come back to that, if we come to these verses in the study and in the next chapter. So I just wanted to sort of draw that out. So after his teaching on renunciation, he teaches on the nature of mind again in the last verses of the last song. I'm not going to go into all that in detail, but I'll just pick out one or two things which I think are interesting. Well, the first verses are about the realization of mind and a deepening realization, stabilization of that experience, aren't they? So he says, you know, like space, the Dharmakaya pervades all sentient beings, but we don't realize that, so we're driven into samsara. But that is the nature of mind. It's easy to glimpse it, so it, you know, we might get a glimpse of that, but then it's not easy to stabilize it. So we need not just a path of vision, but a path of transformation. And even if we, and then if it is stabilized, this is the one I wanted to bring out. If that realization begins to be stabilized, so we have an experience of the nature of mind, the senses move freely and do not cling. I think that's rather lovely. So that kind of points to it's not the senses that are the problem, or sense experience which is the problem, or sense objects which is a problem. The difficulty is that you know, we have a fixed sense of self, and then some idea that the object is fixed or can give us some kind of satisfaction that it can't give us because actually it's impermanent. So normally we're in the territory of grasper and grasped, aren't we? Subject and object. And if we can live in this kind of view or sense of the nature of mind, then the senses move freely. We can enjoy our sense experience. And that comes up later on as well. It's repeated. In an undistracted mind, the six non-attached senses arise. Yeah, so the senses operate freely and don't give rise to craving. That one's at one with the trikaya, unattached, walking with power, free from clinging. So it's just a kind of gives us a sense of, you know, how we could be and how sometimes we are. I think if we we're on retreat and we're more concentrated, you know, we do have a sense, don't we, of looking at things with a greater sense of aesthetic appreciation, freedom from clinging and attachment. So we do have this kind of experience, but there's a sense that this could be our continuous experience if we lived in this view of mind. We could just be free of clinging. I think that's where Minarepa's kind of joy and appreciation comes from. You know, from he does enjoy his sense experience in a quite a simple, natural way. So he gives them quite profound teaching. He gives them a glimpse of that, a glimpse of perfect vision, and that's the end of that part of the story. So on to the second song. So this is Minarepa's first meeting with Rucchungpa. So at the end of the previous song, he's in a state of illumination, Minarepa, and in that state of illumination he has a vision of the Vajradhakini, which is Vajrayogini, which is a kind of higher intuitive aspect of his own mind. And she prophesies his many, many disciples, one of whom is going to be his moon-like disciple, and he is waiting for him in Upper Gung Tang. So off he goes. But on the way, he meets the builders. It's not Bob the Builder, it's probably Dorje the Builder, but anyway, he meets the builders. He meets these people who are building a house, and he asks for food. And they say, well, we don't have time for that kind of thing. Sorry, we don't have time for that kind of thing. We're busy. You seem to have plenty of time. You're not doing anything. So why don't you join us and build the house? And I suppose then the implication is, well, then he might get some food. So what does Milarepa do in response? What does he sing or say in response to this? He says, yes, I do have leisure. And I've earned my leisure. I've earned it by finishing the construction of my own house in my own way. And he says, doesn't he, well, even if I don't get any food from you, I would never work on a worldly house. I just reject that. So I would certainly abandon that. So it's quite a kind of confrontational communication, isn't it? Both have got their, take their stand, as it were. Though Milarepa takes his stand on emptiness. Of course, Milarepa has done a lot of building work in his time. We know that. Maybe they don't know that, but we know that. We know he's built, you know, however many years it was, 9 years, 12 years, I don't know, probably 12. Many years he's been building towers and all kinds of buildings for Marpa, and he's been tearing them down and building them again and carrying stones on his back and suffering from enormous sores. And so we know he's done that. So he's finished his building work, that kind of building work. And also, he's finished the building of his house in his own way, which is the building of himself. His work is finished. So it's got echoes, isn't it, of the Arahants, you know, that sort of saying in the Pali Canon. How does it go? Done is my task, laid down is my burden. And also, interestingly enough, the Buddha, house builder, I know you, the ridgepole is broken. So, you know, that, again, a building metaphor, the house of ego in that sense is done. The ridgepole of ego is broken. So, you know, there's all these kind of implications arise out of this communication. And he would rather not eat than help. So he's got no intention of compromising at all. So you could think, and this is what I thought, well, so why doesn't he help them? You know, he's a bodhisattva, for heaven's sake, isn't he? He is a bodhisattva. He's dedicated to helping all sentient beings. And we've studied the bodhisattva precepts here last year, I think, a couple of times, Asanga's bodhisattva precepts, where, you know, the 64 bodhisattva precepts unfold in great detail that the bodhisattva helps sentient beings in whatever way, on whatever level, with whatever they need help with. So why doesn't Milarepa help the builders? So I thought about that. And I also thought, oh, it's interesting. Kukai popped into my mind as well. Another figure on our refuge tree, Japanese teacher. And I just remembered that he... he built monasteries, and he longed always to be in Mount Kaiō, but he was always getting hauled down to the city by the Japanese emperor to do other kinds of building, to build dams and, you know, to do whatever, because he had sort of engineering skills, and he would go and he would do it with grace and generosity, but he really wanted to be back in isolation in his monastery. So, you know, that came to my mind as well. And thinking about the bodhisattva precepts and the bodhisattva ideal, one of the bodhisattva precepts is that the bodhisattva expresses what's called the ethics of gathering, which is the ethics of gathering sentient beings. So the bodhisattva gathers a community, a spiritual community, through the four Sangravastus, and he gives himself as a resource, but he also provides resources. Provides whatever resources his disciples need. So, you know, back to why, I suppose, so many great teachers and so many of them on our refuge got into building, you know, built monasteries. Some of them, you know, who was it, built 35 monasteries? Another of those Japanese teachers, I think, Tsongkhapa, you know, kind of much building. So you could think, well, is there anything wrong with building? And why doesn't Milarepa help them build? So maybe Milarepa has a sense of, I suppose it's what you build, isn't it, and why you build it. It's what's important, what you're building and why you build it. And Milarepa perhaps has a sense of their motivation for building, why they're building, what they're building. So they're building presumably a house, and well, maybe he sees that their motivation for building is, maybe it's partly skillful, people need shelter, but maybe it's for security and comfort. Maybe there's some kind of craving involved, maybe it's for possession, maybe there's some kind of complacency, maybe they're not seeing the provisional nature of their building, what they're building and why they're building it. Maybe they're caught up in the eight worldly winds. And it seems as though he sees the building of that kind of house as a metaphor for samsara, for the kind of the building of ego and all the attachments that go with that, and you know how samsara just comes out of that, and the whole kind of cycle of birth, life and death, which is for us lived in buildings, isn't it, as it were. So we live in a building and we build, so we construct our ego, you know, it's kind of inner construction and outer construction, you could say. It's all, you know, so all these kind of metaphors are kind of happening. So it's not necessarily that it's a bad thing to build, but I suppose it's to do with, yes, to do with our motivation. And if we're building ourself, our ego, and we're building our properties, you know, completely immersed in samsara and the kind of responses to samsara without any other kind of openness or vision, then we're totally caught up in samsara. And this is just not Milarepa's way. He's not a builder in that sense, even of monasteries. He is a radical, he's a great yogi, he's a radical renunciate, he's a forest renunciate, living up in the caves and mountains and the snow mountains. And he has given up everything in order to practice in that way. And he's completely free, isn't he? He sort of exemplifies that sort of par excellence. He has no possessions. Well, he's got a loincloth and a bowl, and sometimes he's got a staff. There is a song of the staff. And sometimes he hasn't even got a loincloth and a bowl, because there is a story, isn't there, where it's very, very windy and he keeps getting blown over and his loincloth is up on a somewhere, twig of a tree or something, and he drops his bowl. So Eddie sings a song about that, doesn't he, probably? I can't remember the whole story. So he got nothing. Is his cloak, was he? He's still got his loincloth.
Well...
whatever. Anyway, he's got very little. And then in a song later he says, I don't get molested by robbers, but actually he does. And robbers come, don't they? And there's one song, again, story where robbers come by night and, you know, looking around the cave to see what they can get. And he says, well, if you can find something here by night, you know, that's great, because I can't find anything here by day. So, and then there's a story of he's up in the snow caves, and it snows for 6 months and nobody sees him. And when, I can't remember who it is, comes back to look for him, maybe it's Rachunpa or some patron come to look for him, and they ask about him down in the village, and people say, well, we did hear about someone called Milarepa, but, you know, that was 6 months ago. So 6 months are being snowed in, and they go up, and I mean, they're just convinced that he's going to be dead, you know, so... Anyway, he's there. There's a whole story around that. And he's there kind of happily kind of doing what he does. And they say, well, you know, what did you do for food? So he had some supplies of food, but then that ran out. And he says, well, I just, the Dakinis fed me. And, you know, I had melted snow. Presumably he melts it on his body because he can practice Tumo. So you get a sense of, you know, you do have a sort of radical opposition here of someone, you know, who just has nothing and... wants nothing, is renounced everything, and has everything at the same time, has everything, because he's completely realized, he's got, you know, he realized bliss void illuminating mind, and is completely free and joyful with that. So he has nothing and has everything, and he gives his everything, doesn't he, completely freely to everybody, you know, who, even though he's sort of up in the cave in the mountains, you know, people seek him out, or he comes down and he gives his realization on the spot to everyone. And he doesn't ask for much, just a bit of food. And that's what he's asked for here. But it's not a sort of quid pro quo, is it? It's not on that basis. It's, yeah, he's given the builders, in a way, he's appeared and he's given them the opportunity to practice generosity. And, you know, he's there willing to make a connection. He doesn't want more than that. He doesn't want offerings. He's like Naropa and Asakagul, doesn't want it. I remember those stories about Chetel Sanjay Dorji, like this one of Bhante's teachers, that people give him offerings and sometimes he just says, don't want it. Just doesn't want it. So, you know, this is Minarepa, and here we have the builders. And he didn't build monasteries or institutions. That was not his way. But it didn't mean he didn't gather a community. He gathered this vast community of disciples on all kinds of levels. Those who wanted to live in his way could go with him and live in that way. Otherwise, people were his faithful patrons and disciples living their lifestyle in the way they did. So the builders presumably don't know who he is, and you know, what do they see? They see a semi-naked, slightly green, presumably pretty grubby kind of tramp, really. So it turns out wants some food, you know, and they say, well, you know, work for it, you know. Well, work for it, you're not doing anything. And I suppose we know that, we probably know that response to ourselves, don't we, in some way or other, maybe from our own family and friends who don't practice, who say things to us like, why haven't you got a proper job? Well, I know some of you haven't got proper jobs. Or, you know, why haven't you got a family? I know some of you have got families. But, you know, that kind of thing. So, and if you've got a job and a house and a family, so, you know, but why aren't you kind of, you know, why haven't you got huge amounts of savings? Or why aren't you saving? Why haven't you got, you know, the biggest car you could have? Or, you know, why haven't, you know, or whatever. Or why do you go on those retreats? Or, you know, why do you do what you do? Why do you meditate? Or, you know, why are you weird? So, even if you've got all those things, you know, some of you I know, you know, probably reasonably well healed, and that's fine. But probably you still have people who kind of don't get what you do with your spiritual life. So perhaps we can sort of relate to their response, but they just don't, who is this guy, what's he doing? They don't get it. And there are stories like this, I think I said this in the introduction, there are stories like this in the Pali Canon, which is interesting. So the Buddha, as the forest renunciate, the unlooked for kind of meeting folk. And there's one called Dhania, the Dhania Sutta, where Minarepa turns up, not Minarepa, the Buddha turns up. And the Buddha is a silent beggar. He doesn't ask for food, he just stands. So he turns up at dusk at Dhania's house, and they have this kind of sort of dialogue, which kind of isn't a dialogue. Dhania keeps saying, I've got this and I've got that. My cows are in, my fire's lit, my roof's on, you know, I've got a nice wife, got sons, you know, and he goes through this series of verses, like, you know, I'm set up, I'm all right, Jack, I'm fine. And the Buddha just says, you know what he's doing, the opposite, you know, I my mind is open, let it rain, you know, and it's open the thatch, isn't it? Rain, Deva, rain, it's that. And so they, you know, it's a sort of confrontational series of verses. And in the end, the Buddha says, I have nothing. And, yeah, Dhania kind of, obviously he's kind of resisting the kind of eruption of the transcendental into his very comfortable mundane life. But in the end, he can't resist the Buddha, and he goes for refuge. You have to read the whole sutta, but similarity. And there's another one with Farmer Bharadvaja. It's a bit more similar in a way, from the chapter of the snake in the Sutta Nipata. So he's ploughing. He's got 500 yokes. So he's a, you know, well-established farmer ploughing his field, and the Buddha appears and stands to one side, you know, again silently begging. And the farmer says, well, Master Gotama, he knows who he is, obviously, but refers to his family. Now, I plough and sow, and then I eat. So why don't, when you've ploughed and sown, then you can eat. So it's quite similar, isn't it? And the Buddha says, I plough and sow, and I have ploughed and sowed, or I do plough and sow, and I eat. So again, the farmer sort of, well, we don't see your yoke and plough, Master Gotama, so can you tell us how you do it? So it's similar, isn't it? The builders say, well, How do you do it? And in the farmer Bharadvaja interaction, what the Buddha does is use agricultural metaphors to say what he's doing and how he's created himself, so that they, you know, there is common ground in the communication. So he says, faith is the seed. It's lovely, isn't it? Faith is the seed. That's what I'm sowing. Faith is the seed. Practice is the rain. Modesty, my pole, and mind the strap. I suppose there's a pole and a strap with the oxen, isn't there? Not very au fait with ploughing. Mindfulness, my share and goad. With truth, I clear the weeds. And full of bliss and vigour, my team and yoke, etc. So there's a kind of some of the five spiritual faculties there in that interaction. So I just thought it's nice to sort of bring out that kind of parallel, really, in the Pali Suttas and with Milarepa. So the farmer actually gives him food, and the Buddha says, I can't receive it. I don't receive food for having given the Dharma. It's not quid pro quo. It wasn't given immediately, so I can't accept it. It's not my way. You'll have to throw it away. And he says, who else can I give it to? And he says, well, you have to throw it away. And it's been offered to the Buddha. It has got special qualities, even though he can't accept it. So they throw it into a ditch, and it kind of hisses and steams. And then, you know, the hairs on the farmer's body stand on end, and he goes to refuge, and that's the end of that story. So just to give some parallels with Milarepa and the builders. So they say to him, how do you build your house, and why do you spurn our work so strongly? And I suppose you can think, well, maybe if he'd asked for food and they said, yeah, sure, you know, have some food, the communication would probably have gone differently. So they feel he's spurned their work, and in a way they've been a bit kind of, haven't they? Maybe we don't know quite how they were, but maybe they were a bit to him. So he sings in reply how he's built his house, isn't he? And it's built with the five spiritual faculties. So again, faith is the firm foundation of his house. So in with Farmer Bharadvaja, faith is the seed. It's an agricultural metaphor, and it's more sort of dynamic, isn't it? It's got sort of a seed has potential to grow. It's that kind of model. And this is kind of faith is the foundation. It's a more sort of spatial model. And both are kind of lovely images, I think. You know, faith, maybe it's the earth-touching mudra. Faith is the foundation. Faith is the foundation of practice. Faith is the seed of all our subsequent practice. Diligence forms the high walls, so energy, you know, you build your house of yourself with energy. Meditation makes the huge bricks. There's an implication of sitting with, sometimes you want to sit like mountain, you know, sit solidly, so you can meditate solidly with these huge bricks of your kind of practice built up. And wisdom is the cornerstone. Without wisdom, it'll all fall down. It won't be built in a permanent sense, as it were, without wisdom. Wisdom is the kind of radical, transforming aspect. And mindfulness, presumably, is implicit in this teaching. So with these four things, I build my castle, and it'll last as long as truth eternal. So he's creating himself, as it were, from the raw material of himself. He's creating an enlightened being with the five spiritual faculties. The five spiritual faculties are very basic dharmic teachings that he's sort of giving the builders. And he's using their metaphors. With Farmer Bharadvaja, he uses agricultural metaphors. Here he's using building metaphors. So, you know, he's making a connection with what they do, with what he does, so that they can kind of make a connection and relate to him. And they're kind of, so they listen, don't they? But they're puzzled, and they can sort of see he has a different set of values, but they want to know more. So they want to know, well, you know, so where are your farms, and who are your parents, and who are your children, who are your wives, and who are your friends? And that's kind of a reasonably common set of questions. And there are other songs like this in Milarepa where he, you know, he uses a set of metaphors to sort of express his own experience in a way that other people can understand. So he gives, doesn't he, a set of metaphors, whole string of metaphors, and he begins with that, with in a way the farming metaphor. Have you anything like our farms? Have you anything like our farms, properties, relatives, companions, wives and children? And what his farming is, the Alia consciousness is the good earth. So he's sowing the seed of the inner teaching in his mind stream, and that sprouts into meditation and fruits into the three bodies of the Buddha. So again, he's using farming metaphors. So it's a lovely, I think it's quite a lovely way of looking at practice. And so he's sowing into his mind stream the Alia, which, you know, where you can sow skillful or unskillful seeds. He's sowing the undefiled seed of the inner teaching. The inner teaching is the seed that is sowed. So it's not just doctrine, it's not just Dharma in that sense. It's some aspect of the teaching that, you know, we resonate with very, very deeply, which really means something to us. So it's kind of sown very deeply. I think that's what it means. So it has a deeper, a permanent effect on us. So that might be different for different, you know, ones of us. What really kind of strikes us about the Dharma, you know, will be sown deeply. And that will kind of sprout our meditation, help our meditation grow and be sustained, and help us transform ourselves into the ripened crop of the three bodies of the Buddha. And very much in Mahamudra tradition, this idea of the tree kaya, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya of the Buddha, which we sometimes think of maybe as external, are their qualities within the mind. It's a transformation of body, speech and mind within us. So this is going to last, you know, this kind of farming is going to last. And he kind of contrasts it with their kind of samsaric farming, doesn't he, at the end of each verse. You get a contrast. So his warehouse is shunyata, which is interesting because shunyata is emptiness. Now, how can it be a warehouse? Shunyata is emptiness, but it's emptiness and openness, which can contain everything. You know, it's that kind of unimpeded aspect of mind, isn't it? That you can contain everything within shunyata. And so this is the jewel, isn't it? The jewel of emptiness as the warehouse, the three jewels, the ten perfections, and non-desire. So again, he's contrasting, you know, worldly jewels with the jewels of his practice. The father and mother Buddha are my parents. You could say wisdom and compassion are his parents. Not very clear what the Immaculate Dharma is my face means. I'm not quite sure what that means, but, you know, presumably the Immaculate Dharma is very much part of his experience. The Sangha are his cousins and nephews. He does have relationships, he does has connections, he has very strong connections, but they're dharmic spiritual relationships. And the guardians of the Dharma are his friends. So again, he's making a contrast. You know, he is related in this kind of way. And so it goes on. The next verse is a little bit more obscure, which we can explore in the study. And but these are his heavenly and lasting wives. So he's got, he farms creatively. He has jewels of practice. He has parents and relationships. He has wives. And he even has children or sons. And I think that's quite an interesting verse where he uses the growth from the baby to the infant to the child to the youth to express the development of the realization of mind. So mind awareness is my newborn babe. So the view, you know, that's the kind of first, it's kind of being able to rest in that nature of mind. That leads to experience in meditation, that's my infant. Understanding and realization grows from meditation, that's my child. And then keeping the doctrine is my youth, my young companion. So I think you could see those as a bit related to the four yogas. resting in mind as one-pointedness, and then taking that deeper and taking it deeper, understanding and realization being one taste perhaps, and having a companion in keeping the doctrine. Perhaps that's, you could say, there's a relationship between non-meditation and post-meditation, taking that into life experience. So it is a little bit confrontational. He gives them, in a way, he gives them a sort of contrast, isn't it, between the reactive and the creative, between the mundane and the transcendental, between samsara and his realization of mind. And perhaps he thinks that's what they need, because to begin with, they're kind of quite immersed in their samsaric pursuits. So he makes that kind of contrast. It's quite kind of challenging in a way. And he takes their existing language and enlarges it, as it were. He also criticises the fact that they're totally caught up in perhaps mundane life, because for him that would be that they would suffer. It would be from a bodhisattva point of view, wouldn't it? But he also offers them this kind of bigger vision, you know, that you can build in a different way, you can build creatively, you can build spiritually, and you can have all those things which you're so involved with, you can have them within, as it were, and that would give you great freedom. So he's using the metaphors that they understand, so he's doing something similar, but also he's doing something quite different. I think both are implied. And he's saying he's very active in his own way. In fact, he's probably much more active in what he's doing, what he's done. So I wonder with us whether, okay, there's a kind of very radical contrast, but perhaps we need a middle way. As we need a middle way with our relationship with our parents, perhaps we need a middle way in relationship to building. So it's not that, you know, we don't build externally, as if you think of the FWBO, and we've kind of built lots of buildings. I've certainly built lots of building sites in my time. and we need, I think we need external activities as a kind of measure of how we're growing and developing. You know, that's why Bhante stresses both what they call direct working on the mind and indirect methods. Sometimes indirect methods are very kind of helpful for us in kind of getting a measure of how we make progress. So we need work and activity, and that, I suppose that's why it's such a positive or essential part of our sangha, isn't it? Work as a tantric guru, whether that's work, you know, within team-based right livelihood or right livelihood in whatever sense. We need to engage our energies in something creative. So we need to build in that kind of sense in order to, you know, have a relationship between the inner building and the outer building, you know what I mean? So, you know, kind of our way of practice in our lifestyle is to create good conditions, but to work in whatever conditions we have and to make the most of those conditions. So, you know, with our right livelihood in the world, you know, or to make that as much of a right livelihood as we can, to make that as beneficial for ourselves and others as we can. If we're practicing a family, then, you know, we practice as creatively as we can in the family situation. We make that kind of creative as possible, whatever we're doing. So I think we probably need, we're probably not, most of us, all the time, I mean, maybe at some points when we're on retreat, we're not probably up to the sudden method and always working directly on our minds. You know, we need activity. So we probably need a bit more of a middle ground, and we could talk about that in the study. So I think there's quite a lot of interesting material in this interaction, and in, you know, quite a simple, he gives initially quite a simple teaching, the five spiritual faculties, and then he takes that a bit further. And he does, through this interaction, you know, there is a karmic, he mentions a karmic affinity, doesn't he, with them at the end of it. They are kind of more open to him, and he says, well, we'll meet again in Udayana, which is a kind of pure land. So there's all kinds of ways of meeting, I suppose. Perhaps he's saying, well, we'll meet in a, you know, in a purely dharmic interaction next time. You can meet on a number of different levels. So sometimes perhaps it's necessary to kind of be a little kind of direct and confrontational to wake people up. He's trying to wake them up, isn't he? I mean, one would have to do that with the, we're not Minaretta, so you would have to be very clear of one's motive. But, you know, we do that in our friendships sometimes. Sometimes, you know, we're very kind and understanding, and sometimes we realise we just, you know, have to be a bit more direct with our friends, or, you know, people have to be a bit more direct with us in order to kind of wake us up a bit. So maybe that's a good thing. So anyway, he then goes off to Upper Gungtang to where he is prophesied by Vajrayogini to meet with the Trungpa. We don't know if he gets any food. Maybe he doesn't care. Really. He probably does, but he goes off. And so then we meet Rachungpa, and we learn about Rachungpa. He's a boy, so we're not quite sure how old he is. Presumably, if he's a boy, he's under 16. And his father's dead. He's raised by his mother and uncle, and he's gifted. He's gifted with memory, so he can recite the stories and texts of the Dharma. And he receives offerings, money, for that. So he's up in Upper Gungtang with his, I think he's herding oxen, and he's riding his donkey, and he comes across Minaretta's cave. So this is going to happen. This is kind of prophesied to happen. And he thinks he hears someone singing. It's quite interesting. He thinks he hears someone singing. So we don't know if Minaretta is singing in the cave or not, but something happens in Rachungpa. And he approaches, and as soon as he sees Minaretta, it says, isn't it, ineffable samadhi arises, and he is transfixed in ecstasy. As soon as he saw Minaretta, an ineffable experience of samadhi arose within him, and for a moment he stood transfixed in ecstasy. Awakened thus from karma, an immutable faith towards the Jutsun arose within the boy. He offered Minaretta all the gifts that he had acquired for his services. So it's a very strong faith reaction, or more than faith, you know, ineffable samadhi and immutable faith arises within him. So, yeah, you get that kind of contrast of the three capacities mentioned in the first story. And it's such a strong experience that he stays with Minaretta and learns the Dharma. He completely forgets his family. And so, you know, they're not getting any money, and they're worried about him, and they're wondering what's happening, and they realize he has been paid. And so you can understand their concern and their worries, and they try to get him back. They try to get him back from staying with Minaretta, but it's not possible. You know, he's kind of had too deep and strong an experience to go back. And we don't quite know what that experience is, but it's obvious he just can't go back to living the life he did. And experience and realization of meditation grew within him. He masters the art of the heat of yoga. He becomes a repa along with Minaretta. So it seems as though his realizations developed very quickly from that initial meeting with Minaretta. So you can understand their concern, but they become angry, and they give in to anger, and they also give in to revenge, don't they? Because they send him a pot on which a curse has been placed, and as a result he contracts leprosy. So that's very, they fall into very unskillful states of mind. So you kind of wonder how deep their love was for him. Was he just a meal ticket? You don't know, really, do you? Or, you know, is it that just love turns to hate and revenge? And just that's how it happens when attachment is involved. He was a good little learner. Yeah, he may have been their meal ticket, although it says they supported him. So yeah, you don't know. But anyway, they do. They fall into kind of very unskillful methods. To give somebody leprosy is very, very strong. Leprosy is such a kind of awful disease to contract. There wouldn't have been a medical cure, presumably, and it's so contagious that you're an outcast with leprosy, and you know, bits die and fall off, basically, don't they? So he hopes to be cured, and he confines himself in the hermitage for meditation. So maybe there is, he does have a sense that he could cure himself through meditation, but it might be quite a long process, and maybe he won't. And so the five yogis appear from India, and they through some intuitive process, they realise what's happened, and they're very shocked. What a deadly disease! So they know they've caught it, even though he might not have the signs yet at this point, the physical signs. So you are indeed a pitiable person, deserving of sympathy. And they know someone in India who can cure leprosy, and he wants to go, and Mirappa gives him permission to go. So I was thinking about this, and there is a story. It's in the mind training, lineage in India. No, maybe it's later in Tibet. There's obviously a tradition that the mind training teachings, the Bodhisattva ideal teachings, particularly teachings within that Bodhisattva ideal of taking difficulties onto the path. If you practice them, there are stories about leprosy can be cured. So, you know, obviously this teacher can teach that method and is able to cure people of leprosy. I have also a memory, and somebody else may know this, remember this more clearly than me at the moment, that in the Pali Canon, lepers come and practice on the edge of the community with the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching, and through meditation, gaining insight, their leprosy is cured. So there's obviously kind of precedent for this, and so off he goes anyway. So Milarepa kind of invokes this Nimarpa's blessings to protect and help Machungpa on his journey. So one, he's sick and he's going away on a long and arduous journey. Two, he's young and he's probably never left Upper Gung Tang before, and he's going off to India, so it's a long journey and he's travelling and anything could happen. he's leaving Milarepa, at least physically, he's leaving his association with Milarepa. He's leaving the good conditions of the hermitage and meditation. So there's probably lots of temptations along the way that he could fall into, and Milarepa gives him words of advice on his journey. So again, he starts, you should renounce the world, you should give up samsaric activities and work hard at the Dharma. So give up the world, practice the Dharma. Again, that kind of contrast. And practice with devotion. Pray to the Lama and the Three Jewels with a sincere heart and not just with words. So bear this in mind as you travel on your journey. When you travel, you need food, you need clothes, and you need some kind of means of transport. So that's obvious. But he's saying, well, take the food of perseverance in samadhi. Again, it's a set of metaphors, isn't it? Yes, you will need food, but that's really what you need. You need to carry on meditating while you travel, which is not easy, is it, as we know, when we travel. you will need clothes, but keep up your practice of psychic heat. Keep up your meditation practice, things I've taught you. And ride the horse of the magic prana mind. So, you know, keep up your kind of practice. It's a particular practice, so keep up your inner energy practice. We could explore what that means in the verse more deeply. So you should always keep the non-defiled mind clean. You should always remember the silver bright mirror of the tantric precepts and observe it without vexation. So in the six perfections, we had you have this precious human birth, and you know you have a possibility of practicing the precepts, so guard them as you would guard your eyes. You have something similar here. Always keep the non-defiled mind clean. So if it's non-defiled, is it not clean? You know, what's the problem? But maybe he's got some insight into the nature of mind, but he's not yet fully realized. So particularly as he's traveling, you know, he could fall back. The gravitational pull could pull him back, so he needs to kind of keep the mind, the mirror of the mind, clean through remembering his tantric precepts, through practicing his precepts. And there'll be particular precepts that he's taken with Milarepa. And observe it without vexation. It's nice, isn't it? So you're practicing the precepts as guidelines, but you know, you're observing that in a kind of positive, natural, creative way. If you're captured by bandits, so the travel would have been dangerous, a long, long distance from Tibet to India over kind of mountains and goodness knows what. So quite possibly he would be captured by bandits. So just, you know, keep your equanimity and don't fall into the eight worldly winds. And conceal your powers and merits. Be humble. So, don't kind of be on ostentation anyway, which might draw attention to you. Don't be proud, don't boast. And it may be that Minarepa already knows the nature of Rajungpa, because pride was one of his great failings and was one of his great hindrances. And a lot of their dialogue and Minarepa's training of Rajungpa is around his pride. So then go off and, take with you my blessings, and I hope you recover and enjoy a long life. So I suppose there's an implication in that he'll go. It's such a long journey. It's going to take such a long time. No way of knowing what's going to happen. They may never see themselves again. So in a way, it's quite so poignant that they've met and they've formed this incredibly strong connection. But Minarepa, he lets him go. He needs to go. He lets him go. And, meetings and partings. You just don't know. Minarepa goes back to his cave. Rajungpa seals him in. So it's that kind of... He's in that kind of retreat. He's sealed in, so goodness knows how he's going to do whatever he needs to do. I think there is a whole tradition, isn't there, of dark retreat, which I think Shogyam Trungpa talks about in one of his books, as I think he did one. You have all kinds of realizations in dark retreat. And Rajungpa is off to India, meets the Lama, gets the teachings and is cured, which is great. Then we don't know how long, but he does return to Tibet, comes back to Happy Valley, and people say, we haven't heard of Yogi Minarepa for a while. So he's been so long away, travels at a distance, oh gosh, is Minarepa, is my guru dead? It's definitely his guru. Clay wall is still blocked up. Tears down the wall, and there's Minarepa, upright in meditation. You know, how are you, Minarepa? He gets out of meditation and sings. So. And he sings the song of his happiness, one of the many songs of his happiness, isn't it? He sings and follows the same pattern. He's happy because he has renounced all these things that, you know, we maybe not quite find so easy or happy or think we even should renounce. Left his kinsmen, left his country, even this place that he's happy in, you know, he's not kind of attached to it. He doesn't wear the lofty garb of priesthood, he's not even a monk, he's not got position or status, he's not bothered with that. Yes, I thought about that with, maybe I didn't make that point earlier, about Minarepa and Kukai. Minarepa was beholding to no one. I don't know who was ruling Tibet at the time, but they certainly didn't have any control over Minarepa. So, he's completely free of all position and status. He's not beholding to anyone. House or family, I don't need this or that. I possess the great wealth of the Dharma. So again, I don't have all that, but I do have this. You know, I do have wealth. I have the wealth of the Dharma. I'm not worried about property. If we've got property, we're anxious about it. It's always falling to bits and things need fixing, but Dilila knows that from Tiruvannamalai. So I don't have anything, I don't have any fear of losing anything. I never dread exhaustion. I'm kind of replenished by my practice. I fully realise mind essence. I don't need to force myself to please my patrons. If they come, that's great. If they give me food, that's fine. It's not quid pro quo, it's not like that. It's a free relationship. I'm not fatigued or weary. I don't need to prepare for anything, which is kind of wonderful, isn't it? You know, because he has the wealth of the Dharma, he can just respond in the moment. That's lovely. I never desire to move. I'm not moving out of restlessness. I might move on somewhere else because I've had an inspiration, realisation. I might meet somebody there that I'm going to teach, but I don't move out of restlessness. Bandits and thieves don't molest him. Well, actually, they do. And sometimes they kind of shake him up and down and they're really not very nice to him, but he doesn't mind. I have the best conditions for practising Dharma. I'm happy. I'm not engaged in unskillful deeds. I'm happy. I'm treading the path of merits, I'm not involved in hate or injury. And I suppose, you know, some of it you can contrast back, his own family life, Rechumpa's family. I'm not proud or jealous. I'm not caught up in the eight worldly wings. So it kind of relates back to his advice to Rechumpa, So first of all, you have the teachings on renunciation and what he does have. He does kind of express that. And then again, you move into more direct teachings on the nature of mind. He's happy because he's absorbed in quiet and even-mindedness, so samadhi or some kind of samatha experience. I can use the mind to watch the mind. I'm beyond hope and fear, and so on. So he's, living in the view, as it were, and that's expressed. And again, he comes back to this kind of a positive experience of the senses, which interest me. I can let the six groups of consciousness go by and to return to their original nature. And the five radiant gates of senses all make me happy. So, yeah, he's free from clinging, so he can enjoy his sense experience and his sense consciousness experience. So, oh, I have so much of happiness and joy. This is the song of gaiety I sing. And also, this is a song of gratitude to my gurus and the three precious ones. So, there's joy, there's gratitude, there's happiness. I want no other happiness. And he's also grateful for what he does receive. He doesn't have very much, but for what he received, he is grateful. I'm grateful for the food and clothes provided by my patrons through the grace of the Buddhas and the Gurus. I have no bad sin, or I don't do no bad deeds or sins. I'll be joyful when I die, which is kind of, again, it's a lovely thing to think that we might, if we practice, we might be able to be joyful when we die. Apparently Blake was singing as he died. I'll be joyful when I die. With good deeds and virtue, I'm happy while alive. Enjoying yoga, I am indeed most happy. And how are you? Is your wish fulfilled? So the story ends with Rechumpa wanting to stay in solitude with Milarepa, at least at this point in time. Later, he wants to go off. And, he continues his practice and attains perfect experience and realization, which presumably isn't the end of his realization, but is a level of realization. So this is the story of Milarepa meeting his heart son, Rechumpa, in the cave. I'm sure there's much we can, explore in the end song of the Grey Rock and in the first song, those two parts of the stories in the next chapter.